To the court. We have one case this morning, United States v. Taylor. Major Johnson, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the government?
Yes, Your Honor.
And Captain Beasold, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the government?
Yes, Your Honor.
Very well, then. Please proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, and may it please the court. I'm Major Frederick Johnson, and along with my co-counsel, Lieutenant Colonel Alan Abrams, I represent the appellant in this case, Staff Sergeant James Taylor. Chief Judge Olson, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, please.
Granted.
Thank you, Your Honor. Staff Sergeant Taylor was not in any military duty status for his arraignment and trial because the memoranda purporting to involuntarily order him to active duty were without authority. Two key interpretations support this conclusion. First, the plain language of Article 2D of the UCMJ states that members of a reserve component may not be involuntarily ordered to active duty for UCMJ proceedings except with respect to an offense committed while the member was on active duty or on inactive duty training, which Staff Sergeant Taylor was not at the time of the charged offense.
Counsel, let's suppose we agree with you that the orders were not properly authorized because it doesn't fall within 2D. But he did get the orders, and he did show up on active duty. Is it so clear that if you're ordered to active duty without authority, that you're not on active duty? You make that point in your reply brief, especially your supplemental reply brief, and you cite the Morita case for that. That case involved forged orders. Could it be the case, though, that if you're ordered to active duty and the orders are without authority, the remedy is you can get off active duty, but you're still on active duty?
No, Your Honor. Although the facts in Morita are distinct from this case, the conclusion should be the same. This Court was clear in Morita that unlawful orders or orders without authority are essentially a legal nullity, that they're void.
In your research, did you come across United States against Barraza, that's 5MJ230, and United States against Ernest, that's 32MJ135? Because in both of those cases, one was a guardsman, one was a reservist, and both of them were improperly ordered to active duty. And this Court said, well, that's about, you kind of waive that by showing up on active duty. The fact that the orders were wrong doesn't mean that you're not on active duty. It just means maybe you could get off active duty.
Even though Staff Sergeant Taylor appeared for court, Your Honor, when he first appeared, he immediately challenged the jurisdiction of the court through motions practice. And it was only after the military judge essentially adjudicated that against him and said that he believed that he was on active duty, that Staff Sergeant Taylor continued to appear for trial and continued to participate in proceedings. But that issue was the first thing he did, was challenge whether he was on active duty.
Now, he didn't challenge it under Article 2D, though, did he?
No, Your Honor, he challenged it under some other reasoning, that essentially the orders had not been processed, that he'd never actually been brought to active duty. But it was still a challenge to the essential question, which was whether the court had jurisdiction, because there was a question of whether he was properly on active duty. And since the only authorities purporting to bring him on active duty were orders that went strictly against the text of the statute, this court should not find that he was on active duty. They should find that those orders were a legal nullity.
Okay, even if we agree with that, under 204, let's suppose there's a 204 error, that you got to be on active duty when the court martial starts. Why is that a structural error that can't be forfeited?
Because the court must have power over the person to adjudicate findings and sentences against that person. That's embodied in RCM 204b1, but it gets to the larger issue of jurisdiction, an issue that cannot be waived under the RCM. And if Staff Sergeant Taylor was not on active duty, if the court didn't have power to adjudicate findings and sentence over him than simply by showing up after he's challenged it and after being told by the military judge that his challenge was denied. He doesn't somehow then subject himself to that, which the court cannot do if he's not in a military duty status.
But my question is, why do we think 204 is a jurisdictional provision as opposed to a procedural provision?
Because it gets to that authority of the court, Your Honor. If Staff Sergeant Taylor is in no military duty status whatsoever, it's unclear how the court could purport to do anything with regard to him. That's embodied in RCM 204B1 in saying that he must be on active duty, but it gets to that bigger question. If he's not in any military duty status, that's a jurisdictional issue. He must be in certainly some status. RCM 204 specifies it must be active duty.
Let's suppose we don't agree with that, but maybe we will agree with that. But let me just ask my last question here, and then I'll let the other judges take their turns. I'm sorry to be a hog here, but let's suppose that we decide 204 is just a procedural, not a jurisdictional issue, and that it can be forfeited. In this case, it was forfeited. Why should we conclude that it's clear? I think there would be prejudice because he wouldn't have really tried. They would have dismissed the case. But why is it clear and obvious that he wasn't on active duty when we don't have any interpretation of 2D and, Morita is not really on point? Why would you say it's a clear and obvious error?
It comes to the plain language of Article 2D, Your Honor, for the plain and obvious error. The plain language says that a convening authority may not involuntarily order members to active duty. It starts with that default that cannot be done, and then provides two exceptions to that. And since it's beyond dispute here that neither of those exceptions were met, Staff Sergeant Taylor was clearly not on active duty or on IDT at the time of the offense. That plain reading should create the plain and obvious error. Had the court consulted Article 2D or had the parties discussed Article 2D, that's the reading that would have come through, and then that's the conclusion that the court would have reasonably made. And so it's that plain reading that gets to the plain and obvious error. And that plain reading should be the end of the analysis for the court. The precedent is clear that when you're doing statutory interpretation, you start with the plain meaning of the text. And if it's clear, if it's not ambiguous, and if it's not absurd, that's where the analysis ends. And that's the situation we have here. Article 2D is plain. There's no ambiguity in the text itself. And the meaning of it is not absurd. It doesn't shock it's not grossly shocking to the general moral or common sense, and it's something that a reasonable Congress could have intended. And that's what this Court has said is the question when it comes to absurdity, is not what Congress actually did, but what a rational Congress could have done. And a rational Congress here could have essentially made an incremental change to the jurisdiction under the UCMJ, or put limits on the ability to bring military reservists onto active duty for trial by court-martial. If that's an oversight, if that's an error on Congress's part, then it's for Congress to fix. The Court has been clear, as has the Supreme Court, that it's not within the judicial function to fix Congress's drafting errors.
Counsel, CCA, I'm going back to your point when you list your three and ambiguity. And the CCA addressed this in an alternative fashion. Their original analysis was that it is ambiguous because of the term IDT, but then when you look at the corresponding provision in all these letters, 2 Alpha, 3 Bravo, something, that Congress created the new category to fill the gaps. Or their alternative argument was if we say that it's unambiguous, then there's the absurdity. Why is it not ambiguous? Why is it that we should agree that in reading IDT in 2 Delta 2 that it would not also incorporate the previous provision? I have to look at the numbers, but yeah.
Yes, Your Honor, for two reasons. First, because the distinction between IDT and the periods between IDTs is clear in Article 2A. That distinction is maintained and should also be applied to Article 2D.
Okay. And so then with regards, I think you were about to go to the absurdity issue. So, all right, you can just go, because that was going to be my follow-up question then, because they did decide it in the alternative.
Yes, Your Honor. And the court in the lower court, in reaching that conclusion that it should apply absurdity, also had an error in reasoning when it comes to ambiguity. It essentially said, well, we can look at ambiguity in terms of what Congress meant to do and find that the statute is ambiguous. But that's a misapplication of this court's precedent on finding textual ambiguity. Essentially, the lower court said, well, we're going to look at legislative history to find ambiguity, when the proper application of ambiguity is, or excuse me, the proper application of legislative history is to resolve ambiguity. You can't introduce it to make a clear text ambiguous. You can only introduce it to make an ambiguous text clear. And that's where the court below erred. And then when it reached its ambiguity argument, it also found that somehow the idea that members simply could not be involuntarily ordered to active duty for these proceedings would be absurd. Excuse me, I said ambiguity, I meant absurdity.
Mm-hmm.
Found that it would be absurd because then it would be essentially impossible to effectuate the jurisdiction which Congress had given it. It's not impossible to do so. There are simply limits on it. And the limits that Congress placed are ones that a rational Congress could have done. Indeed, previously, before 1986, to have UCMJ jurisdiction over reservists at all, they had to accept voluntary orders. That's one way that that the military could effectuate jurisdiction, even under the plain language of Article 2D. And before 2019, there would have been no jurisdiction in this case whatsoever. So it's not irrational to think that Congress made an incremental change in allowing jurisdiction, but placing limits on when that could be exercised. Perhaps as an expression of preference for civilian jurisdiction in cases like this, where an offense is committed between IDT periods. But because a rational Congress could have done it, it's not absurd. It's not a case, it's not one of the rare cases that this court should apply the absurdity doctrine to overturn the plain meaning of the statutory text. And applying that plain meaning leads to the conclusion that Staff Sergeant Taylor was not on active duty or in any military duty status. Again, if that is an error on the part of Congress, if that's something that Congress, that was an oversight on their part, then Congress could fix that tomorrow. They could have already fixed it in the intervening years since 2019. But it's for Congress to fix, not for this court to overturn the plain language of the statute in an attempt to do so. And that's essentially what the lower court did. The lower court looked at this and said, well, we think this is what Congress really wanted. We think Congress wanted them to be able to involuntarily order people like Staff Sergeant Taylor to active duty. Therefore, we're going to interpret the text in a way that allows that to happen by including the periods between IDT within the meaning of on IDT in Article 2D2. And that's expanding the statutory text to give it meaning that the court thinks Congress intended, which is against the text Congress actually enacted. As the Supreme Court has said, that transcends the judicial function. That was FCCA's primary error in its reasoning in this case, is reading the text in a way that expands its meaning beyond the plain language. And there's simply no ambiguity in the plain text that the court could use in order to do that. The court had to look beyond it to introduce ambiguity in a way that is prohibited by this court's precedent.
But did the court look beyond it, or did the court look at two different provisions and say, if you do a plain meaning analysis, these two provisions are facially inconsistent?
The court claimed to do that, Your Honor, but really it misapplied that when it looked at the context of Article 2A. It's not inconsistent. The inconsistency is to read it the way the court did, to say, well, even though Article 2A makes a distinction between being on IDT and in these additional periods, we're going to find that in 2D, a later subsection of the same statutory provision, they actually mean the same thing. The one actually encompasses the other. Based on the presumption of consistent usage, the distinction that's in 2A between being on IDT and being in the additional periods listed later should continue into Article 2D. And that's how the context actually supports the plain reading of Article 2D, because that distinction is clear in Article 2A and should be carried over. It's also the same distinction or an equivalent distinction to what this Court made in United States versus Hale, where it found that the meaning of on IDT, on inactive duty training, is simply the four-hour block of time during which a member is signed in for IDT, not the whole weekend, not the period surrounding it. Those are all consistent, Hale with Article 2A, with Article 2D. The Court's reading introduces a different twist on that and finds that somehow the language in Article 2D should actually include these periods between IDT. That's a misuse of the context. That's a misapplication of the canons of statutory interpretation, and it should be rejected by this Court in favor of a plain reading of Article 2D2 that says exactly what the text says. Members of the reserve components may not be involuntarily ordered to active duty for trial by court-martial or other UCMJ proceedings, except with regard to offenses committed while on active duty or on IDT. Since Staff Sergeant Taylor was not, the orders here that specifically invoked Article 2D as their authority for involuntarily ordering him to active duty were without authority. They are therefore a legal nullity, and this Court should find that Staff Sergeant Taylor was not on active duty at the time of his trial, and that therefore the court-martial lacked jurisdiction to try him, and its findings and sentence should be set aside.
Any questions from the bench? Seeing none, thank you. Major
thank
Johnson.
You, Your
Honor. Captain?
Chief Judge Olson, members of the Court, may it please the Court. I am Captain Heather Beasold, and along with my co-counsel, Lieutenant Colonel Jenny Liebenau, we represent the United States. Article 2D is about procedure, not jurisdiction. It is an administrative tool to make sure that a reservist will be present for trial. It does not dictate whether or not we can try them in the first place. Because any alleged noncompliance with Article 2D is not a jurisdictional issue, appellant waived this administrative issue. When his
Captain, I hate to interrupt you. Would you be willing, please, to move the microphone down and toward you? Thank you.
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. Appellant waived this administrative issue when his trial defense counsel conceded that Article 2D was the proper authority to recall him. And even if appellant did not waive this issue, this Court should affirm the lower court for two reasons. First, appellant was not prejudiced by any alleged error in his recall order because he could have been recalled using independent recall authority and his court-martial would have proceeded the same manner. And second, the plain language of Article 2D shocks general common sense by arbitrarily and irrationally restricting the prosecution of reservists for crimes committed just moments apart. Beginning with Article 2D, the nature and the plain language of Article 2D makes it clear that it is not a jurisdictional provision, that it is merely an administrative tool that can be used to rapidly recall a reservist to stand trial. Article 2D clearly has permissive language. It says that a reservist may be involuntarily recalled using that provision. It's not mandated that that provision is used. And in fact, the existence of other ways that a reservist can be involuntarily recalled for court-martial demonstrates that Article 2D further is not a jurisdictional provision, and any error in its application is administrative in nature and can be waived.
Counsel, what about the appellant's argument that under RCM 204, you have to be on active duty? So even if there's some sort of error, even if 2D is not jurisdictional, 204 is jurisdictional, and if he's not on active duty, the court-martial can't try him.
Your Honor, RCM 204 is not jurisdictional. The President doesn't have the authority to expand or limit the jurisdiction that's created by Congress. What the President did in RCM 204 was create a procedural provision, a preference, that reservists will be on active duty for their courts-martial. And so any error or any noncompliance with RCM 204 is an administrative issue that should have been raised at trial and was otherwise waived when it was not.
Can I ask a separate question, the same question I asked appellant? Let's suppose that we don't agree that we agree with appellant's interpretation of 2D, and we conclude that the orders calling him to active duty were unauthorized. Does that mean he wasn't on active duty?
Your Honor, it doesn't. It means that there was merely a clerical error in the way that the way that the orders were drafted. The orders could have cited 10 U.S.C. 12301 Bravo to involuntarily order him for his court-martial. Just because they cited the incorrect provision, it doesn't divest the court of its otherwise lawful statutory jurisdiction. And so he was on active duty at the time of his trial. And additionally, we had jurisdiction, personal jurisdiction over appellant at the time of trial through attachment. Jurisdiction attached over appellant at the peripheral of his charges where he was on active duty at that time. And RCM 202 indicates that jurisdiction, personal jurisdiction, once it attaches, it continues all the way up to the court-martial.
Well, and but weren't those charges dismissed?
Yes, Your Honor.
But didn't that phase, I agreed that jurisdiction attached for a while, and then the government dismissed the charges. And then for a while, there were no charges. And then the government preferred charges. So now there's new charges. But that wasn't while he was on active duty or IDT, right?
That's correct, Your Honor. The second peripheral, he was not on active duty or on IDT. But that doesn't make the attachment of jurisdiction disappear. There's nothing that...
Well, why not? Why not? I mean, what was his legal status in the military justice system after the charges were dismissed?
Your Honor, his legal status, as far as the courts-martial was concerned, we had personal jurisdiction over him.
He was a suspect? Well, what was he?
Your Honor, at that point, once charges had been dismissed, it could be that he reverted back to suspect status, but there are other ways that jurisdiction attaches. Jurisdiction can attach
during an
investigation.
But your original argument was jurisdiction for the later court-martial attached originally, but then the charges were dismissed, and he goes back to being a suspect. So then jurisdiction has gone away.
Your Honor, I would disagree that jurisdiction goes away.
So you would have jurisdiction over him forever? For what charges? For any charges? For only the same charges if they reattached? For any charge the government might choose to bring in the future for any reason? What are the rules around this?
We would have jurisdiction over him for the charges for which jurisdiction attached. And that jurisdiction would only go away at the point at which he had entirely separated from the military and the military no longer had jurisdiction over him, basically by him getting a DD-214 is the only way that jurisdiction would unattach for charges for which it had previously attached.
So the government's position is you can forever create jurisdiction by filing charges and then dismissing them until the end of their status with the military?
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct. That personal jurisdiction would continue once it has attached. Whether or not we exercise that personal jurisdiction is another issue with, statutes of limitation and things like that. So it's not like the reservist would be
constantly. And to be clear, if he was in the reserves 30 years and then he retires and now he's a retiree, he's still in the military, he could be 80 years old and the jurisdiction for those charges would still be attached.
Your Honor, the moment at which he had received his
charges that were dismissed 50 years earlier.
Yes, Your Honor. Up until the point he received his DD-214, once jurisdiction has attached, there's nothing in case law or that has been enacted by Congress that states that jurisdiction unattaches, except by the issuance of the DD-214. So once jurisdiction attaches, it does continue.
And what is in statute or case law that says it attaches forever?
Your Honor, nothing explicitly says that it attaches forever, but where it has only been explained that jurisdiction is lost upon the issuance of a DD-214, that conveys that otherwise once jurisdiction attaches, it continues. And so...
Well, counsel, because I want to, in the course of that back and forth, I want to make sure that we are talking about the same thing, because Judge Hardy proposed a in responding to your answer about the first set of charges being dismissed, then we got back and forth into how long jurisdiction would continue. And I agree that under Article 3D, it says that for reservists, that is, as long as they were subject to the chapter, subject to the code at the time of the offense, then a change in their status, you know, keeps them amenable to being subject to the code. So I think that that's what you were talking about. But then we put in these changes. So I just want to make sure that it's the government's position. Essentially, you're resting on Article 3, that once jurisdiction vests over an offense that was subject to the code, and in this instance, the appellant's offenses occurred during the gap period, which is covered under 2 alpha 3, whatever the letters are. But that it's your position that is that jurisdiction that remained, and once you re-prefer charges, that's the jurisdiction you're talking about.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. I was in the back and forth. I wanted to make sure I hadn't gotten lost. Okay. Thank you.
Yes, Your Honor. And so appellant was in an active duty status both through his orders and through attachment at the time of his court-martial. And so his court-martial had jurisdiction over him for the offenses that he was tried, and his conviction should be maintained. But even regardless of that, appellant affirmatively waived this issue, and so there is no issue for this court to correct. Appellant's attorney specifically acknowledged that Article 2D was the authority to recall appellant onto active duty. At that moment, he could have raised the issue of whether or not Article 2D was the proper procedural authority to recall him at all.
But that waiver wasn't particularly clear, though. I mean, he sort of an aside in making another point. He said, "I don't object. We don't contest the authority. We just say that it wasn't done on this proper form." I mean, he didn't cite 2D specifically. He said, "I'm not making a 2D argument." I mean, how much can we read into that, those three or four words?
Your Honor, those words should be given great weight, because he said that certainly Article 2D was the authority to recall his client. And so that is an affirmative waiver. That's an acknowledgement that Article 2D is the authority, and then any failure to raise the issue with that is waiver. And so his words should be given great weight, Your Honor.
And appellant says it can't be waived. Appellant says that you can't waive jurisdiction. And so even if he said it, it doesn't matter.
Your Honor, appellant is correct that you cannot waive a jurisdictional issue. But the recall authority of Article 2D is not a jurisdictional issue. It is an administrative or procedural error, potentially. And so it absolutely can be waived, and it was waived in this case. Even if this court disagrees that there's waiver and feels that appellant only forfeited the issue by failing to raise it at trial, there still was not plain error in this case. First, because appellant was not prejudiced, but second, because should this court find the need to interpret Article 2, the plain language of Article 2 produces absurd results that shock general common sense. And so,
well, to that point, I assume you're going to say they produce, the plain language produces absurd results because Congress expands jurisdiction in one part of the statute but fails to expand the Secretary's authority to recall reservists in the other half of the statute. And that would be crazy and absurd. But you just told us a few minutes ago that 2D is permissive and they don't really need it and they have other authorities to recall people. So why is it absurd then? If 2D is not even really necessary, then why does it matter that Congress failed to expand the authority under 2D but expanded jurisdiction under 2A?
Your Honor, the absurdity lies in the arbitrary line drawing between crimes committed by reservists. And so where a reservist commits a crime during their lunch break and another reservist commits a crime during their work hours just a couple of minutes later, let's say that I can give this court an example to kind of highlight the absurdity of this. So the one reservist on his lunch break shoots his commander. the other reservist comes back from his lunch break. As soon as he's back on...
I think we all get the tension between 2A and 2D. The question is, what kind of mistake was it? You seem to have abandoned the ambiguous approach, which I'm grateful for. But let's say 2A clearly says expansion has been would include these periods in between IDTs. In 2D, Congress failed either intentionally or out of negligence to expand the Secretary's authority to recall reservists. Right, so it creates this problem. Right, you can commit an offense just like the one we have here. You can commit an offense when the military has jurisdiction over you, but the Secretary doesn't have any authority to recall you. Now, earlier you told us, don't worry about it, because they have other authorities. They can recall them otherwise. So it's not really that big of a problem, which raises the question, well, then why should we care, right? Why should we effectively amend Article 2D on Congress's behalf to fix a problem that 10 minutes ago you said wasn't really even a problem? Or, you know, is the result so absurd, but now you're telling us they have other authorities, so maybe it's not absurd. Or maybe it was just plain negligence, right? Sometimes Congress just screws up. Is Congress screwing up here and creating exactly the situation we have here where we might have someone who was under the jurisdiction when they committed offense, but no authority to recall them? Is that so absurd that we have to amend the statute on Congress's behalf, which is something the Supreme Court has generally advised us not to do?
Yes, Your Honor. So we stand by our argument that this Court doesn't even need to get to the evaluation of the statute in this case because appellant waived it. But if this Court disagrees and chooses that and decides that it does need to evaluate the statute, the absurdity lies in the arbitrary and irrational line drawing that would occur in the government's ability to rapidly proceed to trial. So the distinction...
I mean, is it any more absurd than the world was in 2018?
Your Honor, it is, because in previously, there was no authority, there was no jurisdiction over these intervals that have now been placed in subparagraph B. But now where Congress has expressly created this additional jurisdiction, the idea that the government is hamstrung in the way that we proceed to court-martial, the speed at which we can proceed to court-martial, based on this arbitrary distinction between whether or not they were on IDT or on their lunch break, is an absurd result. It's irrational, and no rational Congress would intend to draw that line.
Well, I mean, you could say that no rational Congress would have ever meant to exclude a murder that happened during the lunch break, right? But for 70 years, that was the law. And so now Congress expanded jurisdiction theoretically to address that problem, but they forgot to give the secretaries more authority. So, you know, now I guess you've got more ability to court-martial these people than you did in 2018. It's inconvenient. It's difficult for a lengthy trial. It might be impossible. But you're still better off than you were in 2018. And these defendants can always be prosecuted by state authorities, which is exactly the situation we were in 2018. So how is it so absurd? If things are better, things could be better still. You just said it was a practical problem about how to court-martial these people that you have jurisdiction over. How is a practical problem that's better than it was in 2018 but not as good as you'd like it to be so absurd that we have to amend the statute for Congress?
Well, Your Honor, the absurdity lies in the fact that it could be impossible in some cases. There could be a case where a crime happens exclusively in military jurisdiction, a heinous crime that would take many weeks to court-martial, and we would be essentially precluded from exercising our jurisdiction in those cases if we cannot complete the court within the appellant's 2 weeks of IDT.
But don't you have other authorities? You told us right at the beginning you have other authorities to recall these people to active duty.
That's correct, Your Honor, but those authorities are still limited. The annual tour that a reservist has to serve, they can only be involuntarily recalled to serve their annual tour for a period of 2 weeks. And so that limits our court-martial to that 2 weeks, which means we have to get arraignment, motions, and then the whole trial done just during a 14-day period. And in a case that is extremely complicated, such as a murder where there's going to be heavy motions practice, and let's say that murder occurred in exclusive military jurisdiction where civilians have no ability to prosecute it, now we've entirely lost the ability to exercise the jurisdiction that Congress has intentionally given us by expanding Article 2.
And all of that sounded like exactly the pitch you should make to the SASC. or the House Armed Affairs Committee and go to them and say, look, this is great. You expanded our jurisdiction. That solved a problem that we had. But now we have a new problem. And that's that we have this practice. The way you left Article 2D, you left us with, makes it very difficult for us to prosecute these people. And maybe you should give us, the secretaries, more authority to recall them because you forgot to do that in 2018 when you amended our statute.
Your Honor, we could go to Congress with it. But when it is in front of this Court's responsibility is to give effect to the laws that have been enacted. And where Congress has expressly given jurisdiction over these offenses, and the way that the recall authority is written results in an extinguishment of that authority, that is an absurdity that no rational Congress could intend. And so this Court can interpret Article 2 to include the periods in subparagraph B so that that absurdity does not occur. And, Your Honor, so in conclusion, Article 2D is not a jurisdictional provision. It is an administrative tool for the rapid recall of reservists. But if this Court, and appellant waived that issue, but if this Court disagrees that appellant waived the issue, under a plain error analysis, this Court should affirm the lower court. Because appellant suffered no prejudice because he could have been court-martialed under independent recall authority, and the plain language of Article 2D is irrational and shocks the general common sense. And therefore, the periods in subparagraph B should be included in the jurisdiction of Article 2A3.
Any further questions?
Yes. Thanks, Chief. One quick one. With regards to the government's position that Article 2D2 is procedural, I'm trying to remember if you had a citation in the briefs for that.
A citation for Article 2D being procedural?
Mm-hmm.
Your Honor, we don't have a direct citation because Article 2D
has not been interpreted.
Has not been interpreted.
Yeah. I mean, we only found one, and it actually was an Air Force case. So, okay.
Any further questions? Seeing none, thank you, Captain Beasel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Major Johnson.
Every line that Congress draws is, in a sense, arbitrary in that it is an exercise of congressional discretion. And Congress exercised its discretion here to say what limits there are on when a member can be recalled to active duty for UCMJ proceedings. In the same way, the President exercised his discretion here to tighten the jurisdiction of courts martial. The government's argument that the President cannot say anything in the RCM about jurisdiction is not entirely accurate. The President can't expand jurisdiction, but he could tighten it. And that's what happened here through RCM 204. If the government's argument that that is merely a procedural matter is taken to its logical conclusion, that would mean that members who have had charges preferred and referred against them could then be tried by court-martial without being in any duty status whatsoever. That goes against RCM 204, and it simply violates the idea that a member must be in a status for the court to have jurisdiction over that person.
Well, counsel, I don't think that's what the government's position was, that they could be tried in violation of 204. If somebody made an objection under 204, well, then it would be dealt with at that time. But if it's for all, the only point was that it could be forfeited because it wasn't jurisdictional.
The logical conclusion of that, Your Honor, if that can be forfeited, is simply that if a member doesn't object, that they can then be tried despite being in no duty status. That would take the teeth out of RCM 204, and it would go against this Court's statement in United States versus Oliver that RCM 204B1 provides that a reserve component service member who is on active duty prior to arraignment is subject to court-martial jurisdiction. The converse of that is that a member who is not on active duty in accordance with 204B1 is not subject to court-martial jurisdiction at that time.
Counsel, may I ask you to respond to another argument that the government made that, and again, if you think this isn't forfeited or can't be forfeited, then it's not relevant. But if it can be forfeited, the government's argument is this error is harmless because if he had raised it We would have dealt with it. We would have given him new orders. Same trial would have been happened. And there's no error in the trial. It's just on the day of trial, he wasn't on active duty. We could have fixed that some way, so it's harmless. Is that a correct analysis?
Chief Judge Olson, I see my time is about to expire.
Please proceed.
Thank you. Your Honor, that's not a correct analysis. The fact that the government could have done something the correct way should not be used as a blanket excuse for them having done it the incorrect way in this case. If the government had other means to do it, had they exercised those, this would be an entirely different matter. But because it specifically relied on Article 2D to involuntarily order him to active duty for the express purpose of UCMJ proceedings, that's what this Court needs to address. It's the action by the government, not the theoretical options the government may have had to fix their error. The government's arguments on the absurdity of this provision are essentially new iterations of the arguments this Court rejected in McPherson, and they should reject them again here.
Any further questions? Please briefly conclude.
Thank you, Your Honor. Since the text of Article 2D is plain, this Court needs to enforce what Congress expressed in the statute it adopted by finding that Staff Sergeant Taylor was unlawfully recalled to active duty, that those unlawful orders were without legal effect, and that he was therefore not on active duty and not subject to the jurisdiction of the court-martial. This Court should therefore set aside the findings and the sentence of that court-martial. Thank you.
Thank you, Major Johnson. Case is now submitted. The Court thanks counsel for both sides, and the Court will stand adjourned until further order of the Court.
The Court is adjourned until further order of the Court.